Great. I was able to hear you fine, Barry.
Yes, just to check, Kathy, we just have been doing, we haven't started the session yet. We're not about a minute away from the top of the hour, so just making sure everybody can hear okay. So we are speaking right now. If you want to affirm that you're able to hear us, that would be great. Just want to check. I'm seeing that Kathy Gibson is letting us know that she can't hear us. Just is anyone else unable to hear us? If you are, please let us know. We thought we had everything worked out on our end. Between ourselves, we're able to hear each other, but we want to make sure that everybody on your end. So make sure, just check your speakers again. Make sure that everything is unchecked for mute on your end so that your speakers and such are not muted one way or the other. Okay, we are at the top of the hour. Barry's giving you a hint that maybe logging off and back on again can help in the system as an option as well. But we're at the top of the hour, or a little bit past at this point, so I'm going to go ahead and get us started today. Welcome everyone to the ADA Legal Seminar webinar series. Our session this month is titled Interplay Between the ADA and the Family Medical Leave Act. Our speakers for today's session are Barry Taylor and Alan Goldstein. Both of them are attorneys with Equip for Equality, the protection and advocacy organization for the state of Illinois. Both of them have been heavily involved in ADA employment-related issues and have a long history in these various topics. If you want more information and specifics about Barry and Alan's background, you can go to the www.ada-audio.org website and read a little bit more about their background and experience in this particular issue. But I don't want to take too much time in those introductions. This is the second of our series, our six-part series for this particular year. We have a number of topics upcoming. Last month we talked a little bit about performance conduct issues as well as an overview of the ADA Amendments Act. All of us are still awaiting to see what the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission is going to do in relationship to the rules and regulations for the ADA Amendments Act. It's most likely at this point that we won't be seeing anything coming out from the EEOC until after the inauguration next week and some additional positions are named and such related to the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission under the Obama administration. ADA Amendments Act are effective as of January 1 of 2009, even without regulations. We do still have the statute itself. So just a little bit of clarification there. So as we go forward here, I'm going to go ahead and turn over the microphone to both Barry and to Alan. If you want to ask questions along the way, you can do so by inserting or typing your question into the chat area on the site, and we'll be monitoring that to make sure that all questions are heard. And as well as we will be taking time out during the session to let people ask questions and respond to questions, and both Barry and Alan will be doing that as they go through the program today. So I'm going to go ahead and hand over the microphone to Barry and Alan. Go ahead.
Thanks, Robin. Hi, everyone. Thank you so much for joining us today. It's sort of fortuitous that we ended up scheduling this interplay between the ADA and the Family Medical Leave Act, because there are new regulations that have been issued by the Department of Labor that go into effect this Friday of this week, January 16th. And so what we've done is we've developed a brief that Great Lakes will be sending you after this session that has more detail about some of the new provisions on the Family Medical Leave Act, and we will be referring to some of those changes as we go along talking about this in the outline. The format that we're going to do is I'm going to start us off by giving an overview of the FMLA and the ADA, just the sort of the core provisions, and then I'll turn it over to Alan, and he will talk about the interplay between the ADA and the FMLA, so what happens when a person goes on leave and they have ADA rights as well as FMLA rights. And then we'll take a break for questions and see if anybody has any questions for what we presented thus far. And then with the time that we have remaining, we've put together a case study that does an interplay between the ADA and the FMLA. This is also in the brief, but we're going to walk through it as best we can through this format and through the time we have remaining to talk about some real-life scenarios that can come up so that we're not just talking about, you know, sort of theoretical things, but instead talk about some real-life situations that have happened in other cases and that may happen in the future. And then finally, we'll give you some resources for future reference. So first, we're starting with the overview of the ADA and the FMLA. And as most of you who've been working with the ADA know, that the goals of the ADA are broad, and the ADA is a civil rights law. It was modeled after Title VII, which provided protections based on race, gender, ethnic origin, religious belief. And it really was seeking to encompass all aspects of life and to address the historical discrimination against people with disabilities and provide them with an equality of opportunity, full participation and integration, independence, economic self-sufficiency, and remove barriers and provide national standards that weren't in existence before the ADA was passed in 1990. But then when you look at the purpose of the FMLA, it's much more narrow. The FMLA is limited to employment. It doesn't cover all aspects of life like private businesses and public services. And it really was focusing on trying to benefit both employers and employees. There were studies that showed a correlation that stability in the family is correlated with productivity in the workplace, and that if you provide people with some reasonable amount of leave to address issues that come up for their own health issues or for family issues, that can result in more retention for employees and a more stable workplace. And so when it was passed in the early 90s, that was really the goal of this legislation. The FMLA has leave standards, and what it says is that if you're a covered employee, which we'll talk about that in a second, you're entitled up to 12 weeks of medical leave if you fit within one of the following four conditions. The first is the birth and care of a newborn child. Second, placement with the employee of a son or daughter for the adoption or foster care. Third, to care for an immediate family member, and that's defined as a spouse, child, or parent who has a serious health condition. Or fourth, to take medical leave when the employee, him or herself, is unable to work because of a serious health condition. And it's this last bullet point that really is where we're going to see the interplay between the ADA and the FMLA. And the serious health condition is one of those examples where the new FMLA regulations have clarified a bit what that means, and I believe Alan will be discussing that more when we get more into the interplay of what these different terms mean. So in order to qualify, or what the FMLA leave provides on this slide, is 12 weeks of leave within a 1 year, 12-month period. And the 12 weeks may be taken intermittently. They don't have to be done consecutively. You'll see there's a new regulation referenced right under that first bullet point regarding service members or military caregivers. And this is part of the new regulations that provide additional leave for people who fall within this category, service members who are injured in the line of active service or family members who are caring for them. And they would receive up to 26 weeks of leave within a 12-month period. So it's still the 12-month period, but instead of 12 weeks of leave, you'd be entitled to 26 weeks of leave as a military caregiver or a service member who was injured in the line of duty. Alan will go through the next bullet points in more detail, but the FMLA provides for maintenance of health care coverage while you're gone, protection of your job, and as we'll talk about in a second, FMLA leave is usually unpaid, although employers certainly have the discretion to make it paid. It's not required to have it unpaid, but that's what employers are entitled to do under the FMLA. Next slide. So in order to be covered by the FMLA, you've got to meet some conditions. And the first one is that you are working for a covered employer. And by a covered employer, typically that means the employer has 50 employees within 75 miles. And when they say within 75 miles, that might mean that a particular employer has several offices within a certain geographical area. So if you have 15 workers and 40 workers and 25 workers all within 75 miles of each other for the same business, you could you could aggregate those together and still be a covered employer, even if you don't have 50 employees in one particular office. So if it's within the 75-mile geographic area and you have 50 employees, that's sufficient. The 50-employee requirement does not apply to public agency employees or public and private schools. They don't have an employee number requirement to be covered by the FMLA. So the first component is you have to have a certain number of employees. And then the other thing you have to show is that you've worked for your employer at least 12 months, and the regulations clarify that doesn't have to be a consecutive 12 months, but it has to be at least 12 months performing at least 1,250 hours of work. So if you were working for a year but had not worked 1,250 hours within that 12-month period, you would not be eligible for FMLA. And then also there's, again, clarification on military obligations that if you take leave for that military obligation, you're supposed to be credited for the hours of work you would have been performing if you hadn't had left for the military obligations. One thing that's, you'll note the difference between the ADA and the FMLA, if we can go back 1 second, Alan, is that there's a waiting period for the FMLA that you don't, basically for the FMLA you have to wait a year and work a certain number of hours before you can take advantage of that statute. And as you'll see, we won't have that same requirement under the FMLA. Now, again, employers are free to waive that waiting period or to change that 1,250 hours if they want and adopt their own version of the FMLA, but this is the base requirement that's that is set forth in the statute. Now we can go to the next slide. Thanks. So for the ADA, the covered employees are entitled to a reasonable amount of unpaid leave due to a disability. And as those of you who are familiar with the ADA, leave is not required if it causes an undue hardship. So employers always have that undue hardship defense, and we're not going to go through what all that means. I'm sure many of you have worked on that issue before, but you have to provide you can't just say it would be an undue hardship. Employers would have to provide objective evidence to show why it would be an undue hardship to provide the accommodation, including leave. The employee must be qualified for the job at the end of the leave with or without a reasonable accommodation. One thing we often see is that employees take leave under reasonable accommodation, and then they're ready to come back to work, but they need maybe a new reasonable accommodation when they return to work, so maybe modifications to the workplace. And the EEOC in the case law has been very clear that just because you provide one accommodation as an employer does not mean that you don't have a continuing need to review potential accommodations as they're requested by employees. So if an employee is off on leave as a reasonable accommodation, but then in order to return to leave and to be qualified for the job, they need an additional reasonable accommodation, that would be something the employer would have to provide, again, if it would not cause an undue hardship. One thing that's important to know that's different from the FMLA, FMLA is all about giving one thing, leave, whereas here under reasonable accommodation, leave is one of many accommodations that can be provided. So if an employer identifies a different way of accommodating someone, such as reassignment, and find that that accommodation would be effective, that is within the employer's discretion to provide that accommodation as opposed to leave. You don't have an automatic right to leave, even if it would be something that wouldn't be an undue hardship. If an employer identifies a different accommodation that would be effective, it's within the employer's discretion to provide the accommodation, and the employee does not get the preferred accommodation, although certainly one thing the EEOC references is that employers should consult with employees and provide the preferred accommodation when it makes sense and have that as part of the process. But it's not an automatic entitlement. And then the amount of leave must be reasonable. And again, this is really different from the FMLA, which has a specific amount of leave, 12 weeks within a 12-month period, whereas the ADA's drafters specifically did not put in a specific amount of leave because they have this whole concept of individualized assessment. And to put a specific amount of leave of what would be reasonable really would go away from that individualized assessment. So that's a very different type of thing. One other thing I just wanted to mention is that unlike the FMLA, which is leave for yourself or to care for a family member, the ADA leave is really only for the employee themselves, not for a family member. Now, you may remember that the ADA has a provision for association discrimination, meaning that employers can't discriminate against you because you have a relationship, like a family relationship with a person with a disability. But the case law is pretty clear that that does not entitle you to receive leave as an accommodation to care for that family member who has a disability. If you yourself do not have a disability, that the reasonable accommodation of leave is really limited to the person with a disability under the ADA. Next slide. And again, to be covered under the ADA, you have to have a disability, obviously. As I just mentioned before, it can't be just a family member's disability. You also are looking at 15 or more employees, so 15 for the ADA and 50 for the FMLA, and that's for private employers, whereas state and local governments are all covered. They don't have a 15-employee requirement. And you also may have coverage under local laws. So here in Illinois, we have the Illinois Human Rights Act and then county and city statutes that only require you to have one employee. So some employers are covered by the ADA and local statutes, and other employers are just covered by the local statutes. And again, as I referenced before, there is no waiting period to be covered by the ADA like there is for the FMLA. Next slide. And this just lists some of the prohibited acts in the FMLA, and what we just wanted to make sure that people understood is that basically you can't prevent people from exercising their FMLA rights. That in and of itself, if there's some sort of thing hindering people from exercising their rights, that also can be a violation of the FMLA. So violations of the FMLA aren't simply not, you know, providing the leave requested, but any kind of effort to prevent people from exercising their rights, or if you discharge or take adverse action against somebody who opposes the employer's unlawful action, that would be deemed discrimination under the FMLA as well. Next slide. And the next slide just goes into this in a little bit more detail. If you file a charge and there's adverse action taken against you, basically, as we've talked about in previous webinar sessions for retaliation under the ADA, the FMLA has parallel standards. You can't be retaliated against because you are exercising your FMLA rights or because you are complaining about employers' failure to provide the correct actions under the FMLA. Next slide. And then you see the ADA's prohibited acts. And again, one thing that is set forth is that a reasonable accommodation is a statute requirement under the ADA, and not providing that accommodation can constitute discrimination. So under the ADA, discrimination is not limited to firing or somebody with a disability or failing to hire somebody with a disability, but the failure to provide an accommodation that's reasonable is also discrimination under the ADA. And then the last bullet point, retaliation and harassment, can also be a basis of disability discrimination under the ADA. We've had sessions on these in the past as well, but this can really come up a lot in the accommodation section, especially harassment. Coworkers can harass people when they see them, people with disabilities, getting accommodations that they're not getting, and sometimes people harass them because they know they're getting it as a person with the ADA, or sometimes they're harassing them because they just think this person's getting treated differently or treated better in the workplace. And that kind of harassment, if it rises to a certain standard, can be actionable under the ADA, both harassment by co-workers as well as harassment by supervisors. Next page. Slide. Generally, leave under the ADA and FMLA is deemed unpaid. Employers can certainly change that policy and have different provisions, but generally there's not a requirement under the ADA or the FMLA for leave to be paid. There are a couple of buts under the FMLA. One is that the first bullet point, that an employer can require or an employee can elect to substitute accrued time that they have, like vacation or personal leave or sick leave, to go with the time that they're off, so that they are actually paid for the time they're off because they've used the accrued leave that they had. And then also, we have a new provision under the new FMLA regulations, the second bullet point, that now requires to allow employees to substitute their paid leave for FMLA leave when the employee is eligible for that paid leave. And this is something that was sort of more permissive before, and now it's clear that employers are required to follow this policy if an employee requests it and is eligible. Next slide. And Alan's going to go into this in a little bit more detail, but there are a lot of different definitions out there for different laws. And we've already referenced that for the FMLA, what we're talking about is a serious health condition. For workers' compensation, you're looking at having an on-the-job injury, and different requirements may come up with that. And we can have some generalizations about workers' compensation, but each state has its own workers' compensation laws. There is not a federal workers' compensation statute like there is for the ADA and the FMLA. Of course, under the ADA, your coverage is if you're a qualified individual with a disability, and remember that is talking about people who can perform essential functions of the job with or without a reasonable accommodation. And also remember, we now have the new ADA Amendments Act, which takes a much broader view of what qualified individual with a disability actually means, getting back to Congress's original intent. You also have different definitions, such as under Social Security, inability to engage in substantial gainful activity. You might have different definitions of disability under short-term and long-term disability insurance policies. And then you also have state and local human rights laws that also may have different definitions of disability. So this can be a very challenging area for human resource personnel, because you're not only talking about different requirements for leave, and but you're also talking about eligibility differences based on which statute you're talking about. If you're covered by the ADA, it doesn't necessarily mean you're covered by the FMLA or vice versa. So it can be rather challenging in trying to do that. And one of our goals today is to hopefully help get through that minefield safely, especially when we're talking about the interplay between the ADA and the FMLA. And then just finally on the last slide, some complications to consider, and I think some of these things may come up during the case study that Alan has put together, is are we talking about a work-related injury or an off-the-job injury? Because as I referenced before, the work-related injuries could involve workers' compensation laws. Also, are we talking about a temporary or permanent injury to be covered under the ADA and the FMLA? Is the employee seeking a temporary or permanent accommodation? Are we talking about a leave that's used 12 weeks consecutively or in some kind of block? Are we talking about intermittent leave? And then also, is light duty involved? This is another area where the new FMLA regulations come into play. As is referenced on the slide, employers can no longer charge light duty assignments against FMLA leave. And some employers were doing that before, and the DOL regulations make clear that that is no longer permissible to use FMLA time when somebody is put on light duty. So with that, I'm going to turn it over for Alan to talk about the interplay between the ADA and the FMLA, and then after he's finished, we'll open up for questions, and then we'll look at the case study. Alan?
Okay, thank you, Barry and Robin, and welcome everyone. I see we have some returning people from prior webinars and some new people, so we're glad you're all here. And if there are any problems with my microphone, if it fades in and out, or if you stop hearing me, just send a little text message and we'll try to fix it. So I'm going to talk about the interplay of the FMLA and the ADA. Sometimes employers think, well, we provided the 12 weeks of leave that the FMLA provides, we're done with providing leave, and that's not necessarily the case, because that could be when the ADA kicks in. So as a reasonable accommodation under the ADA, FMLA leave may be extended beyond the 12 weeks. It may be given to an employee who is otherwise not eligible under the FMLA, and as Barry alluded to, that could be an employee who has worked at the employer for less than a year. Or it could also be an employee, for example, who needs leave to care for a sibling, because siblings are not covered under the FMLA leave provisions. Well, actually, I take that back. I guess it would be a reasonable accommodation, because ADA doesn't require leave for people to care for others, so let's withdraw that statement. It also can be given as paid leave, as Barry alluded to before. And under the ADA, unlike the FMLA, where if a person qualifies for leave, they get it automatically. Under the ADLA, it's a little more loose. It's a reasonableness standard. And while that's not necessarily vague, our whole system of justice in some ways is based on this concept of reasonableness. What it tries to do is to balance the needs of the employee and the needs of the employer. And in every situation, what is reasonable in a given situation requires an individualized assessment and a fact-specific determination. You must look at the individual, their job, their medical condition, their job duties, and the employer requirements. Can they fill the spot using temporary workers, or can they not afford to have this employee take leave? Those are some of the considerations. According to the EEOC, and you'll note at the bottom of the slide, there's a fact sheet reference which talks about the FMLA, the ADA, and Title VII of the Civil Rights Act. And the EEOC says the law offering the most protections to the employee should be followed by the employer. And usually this is the FMLA because the leave is given if the employee qualifies. And there are different standards for coverage. The definition of disability under the ADA is different than a serious health condition under the FMLA. There are also different requirements for medical certification and notice. There's issues regarding intermittent leave, timing and disclosure, how much notice does the employee provide, what type of documentation must the employee provide, can the employer ask for documentation, and in most circumstances they can ask for documentation to establish the need for the leave. Okay, I will try to back off the microphone a little bit. And under both laws, there's no need for malicious intent. If the employer or the employer takes an action that denies the employee a right, even if it's well-intentioned, even if they're not intending to deny the employee their right, it could still be a violation of the law. There's no need for the employer to act intentionally and say, I'm going to deny you your FMLA and ADA rights. That's not a requirement for there to be a violation. So I moved the microphone. Let me know if that's a little better. Employers have different rights and obligations under the law, as we talked about. The employer can choose any effective reasonable accommodation, which might be something other than leave. Under the ADA, under the FMLA, the leave must be given to the employee if the employee qualifies. And here's a case that illustrates that point. It's the Santa Cruz case. On these cases that we discussed, there'll be a little citation on the bottom if people want to reference the case later. And these cases will also be mentioned in the brief that will be distributed after the fact. And if people want to email me for any information after the fact, they're welcome to do that as well. In the Santa Cruz case, an employer required the employee to use their family medical leave time and sick time to avoid mandatory overtime due to their disability. So the employer said, you don't have to do the overtime, but you have to use your FMLA and sick leave time instead of doing the overtime. The employee didn't want that. The employee wanted something different. He preferred to just be exempt from overtime due to his disability without having to use up any of his sick and FMLA time. And the court went and examined that. One, this case was under the Rehabilitation Act. This was a federal employee, which is the same analysis as the ADA. And the court held that the employer did, in fact, comply with the ADA. Even though it did not provide the employee the accommodation they requested, the court held that allowing the employee to use the FMLA and sick leave time to avoid mandatory overtime was an ADA reasonable accommodation. And the court noted that the person did not use up all their available sick or FMLA time in this case, but I wonder what will happen once the time is used up and they need more time. I think that's probably when the ADA would kick in, and then we'd have to look at whether leave was reasonable in that case. The court also noted that the employer did not discipline the employee in any way for not working overtime or for using their ADA and FMLA time. If the employer had provided the leave and then disciplined the employee for not doing overtime, that could have been an ADA violation as well, possibly retaliation. As we noted, there's different standard for covered employees. The ADA An employee must have, as we know, a physical or mental impairment that substantially limits one or more major life activities, or be regarded as having an impairment, or have a record of an impairment. And it's important to note that under the ADA Amendments Act, all the old law and definition of disability, at least since Sutton, will probably not be good law anymore. And Congress has made it very clear that they want the definition of disability to be liberally construed under the ADA. Under the FMLA, the definition is a serious health condition. And I think there used to be a fairly wide gap. The FMLA definition of serious health condition is seen as encompassing more types of conditions than the old ADA definition. I think under the ADA Amendments Act, this gap will be narrowed, and these two definitions will be closer, although I still think the FMLA definition is a little more broad. And here are some of the language about a serious health condition. It's an injury, impairment, and illness, which involves a period of incapacity or treatment connected with inpatient care in a hospital or a medical care facility, or continuing treatment under the supervision of a healthcare provider, including conditions where treatment's not effective, if there's multiple treatments, if the incapacity lasts for more than 3 consecutive days, or if there's a chronic serious health condition. And under the new FMLA regulations, which actually go into effect this Friday, there was some more clarification provided. For example, the 2 visits to a health care provider must occur within 30 days of the onset of incapacity, and the first 2 visits must occur within 7 days of the first day of incapacity. Periodic visits to a health care provider will be defined as at least 2 visits per year, and also clarifies the first visit to a health care provider must take place within 7 days on the first day of incapacity. So there's some more clarification in terms of how the treatment figures into the definition of serious health condition. And here's a case that discusses it. This is the Verhoff case. In this case, a cable installer claimed that he was entitled to leave under the FMLA and ADA due to his eczema. This would cause irritations, and he had rashes, which would be cause him great amounts of itching and discoloration, and he said that the eczema became very distracting just from the itching and the feeling of it, and it made it very difficult for him to sleep and care for himself, and also affected his thinking and concentrating. In this case, he said that he was sleeping only about 5 hours a night due to his eczema. And the court, under interpreting the ADA, under the old ADA, not the ADA Amendments Act, found that the distractions were not enough to constitute an ADA disability. However, the court went on to say that his condition did meet the definition of an FMLA serious health condition. In this case, there's a couple of things that are also interesting. In this case, the employee checked the wrong box on his FMLA form, and even though he wanted intermittent leave, he checked the box indicating he wanted block leave. And the employer gave him a time of leave, a block time of leave, and then the employee said, well, now I need some leave on an intermittent basis, a couple afternoons a week, something like that, so he wouldn't have to work over 40 hours. And when he asked for that intermittent leave, the employer said, no, you checked the block leave, we're not going to give you the leave, and then almost right thereafter terminated the employee. And because his condition was found to be an FMLA serious health condition, his termination was found by the court to be interference with his FMLA rights. One thing, too, I just want to reference one of the other items of the new FMLA regulations, because this fits in, is if an employee does return to work after leave, employers are allowed to ask that the employee undergo a fitness for duty. But under the new regulations, the employer must furnish the employee with a list of their essential functions to be given to the medical examiner in performing the fitness for duty exam. So that way, when they can say a person is fit for duty, they actually know what that duty entails. The employee qualifications for ADA and FMLA. Under the ADA, an employee with a disability must be qualified to do the job, which means perform the essential functions either with or without a reasonable accommodation at the end of the leave. And again, the employee must work for an employer with 15 or more employees. So at the end of the leave, an employee has some obligation to show the leave will enable them to be qualified for the job at the expiration of the leave. Under the FMLA, it seems almost completely different, but it makes sense because under the FMLA, an employee must show that he is unable to perform the essential functions of the job because that's why he needs the leave. So the ADA is looking at being qualified at the end of the leave. The FMLA is looking at being unable to perform the essential functions in order to get the leave. That's why the employee would need the leave, and this is for their own health condition. And so under the FMLA, an employee must show that they are unable to perform the essential functions of the job. At that time, they don't have to show the leave will enable them to perform the job later, but that might become an issue when it becomes time for reinstatement. Under the ADA, the employee does have to show, at least make some type of prima facie case, why the leave will eventually enable them to do their job. So I hope that's clear. If you have any questions at the end, I will try to explain that a little better. Next, we have notice. And under both laws, it's pretty much true what it says under the ADA. Any language that reasonably informs the employer of the existence of an ADA disability and the need for an accommodation is enough. There's no magic words under the ADA. An employee does not say, I need an accommodation, I have a disability. You know, just my back hurts when I sit too long might be enough to let the employer know that some accommodation is needed. Likewise, under the FMLA, there are no magic words either. As long as the statement reasonably lets the employer know that the employee may need leave due to an illness or injury or condition. Under the FMLA, however, there are timelines involved. The ADA all depends on reasonableness. So the employee should give reasonable notice of leave, etc. Under the FMLA, the employee must provide 30-day advance notice of the need to take leave or when the need is foreseeable. If the need is not foreseeable 30 days in advance, then the employee under the new regulations must let the employer know either the same day they find out they need leave or the next day, which is actually a little tighter than the old regulation. So now if an employee needs leave and it's less than 30 days from the day he needs to start the leave, he must let the employer know either that day or the next day that he will need leave. And again, no magic words are required. We look at the Burnett versus Habitat case. In this case, an employee of a property management company whose job required some lifting and some physical labor had no performance issues. In October of 2003, he informed the company for the first time that he was having some medical difficulties. And around the same time, presumably in an unrelated situation, he was offered a transfer to a different location, presumably due to some personality conflicts with a coworker. When offered that transfer, the employee turned it down because the new location would provide less washroom access, and he told his employer that that would be bad due to his, quote, weak bladder, unquote. And he also mentioned that he was going to see a doctor for that condition. So this is October of 2003. When he turned down the transfer due to his weak bladder. And a few weeks later, in November, the employee received his first disciplinary notice, his first verbal warning regarding performance. And I think one thing that's very important for employers can discipline employees, whether they have a serious health condition or an ADA disability, as long as they discipline other employees for the same violation. But employers should be very careful if they start instituting discipline immediately after learning of a disability, because I think that raises many red flags. I think employers need to make sure that their use of discipline is consistent and that people who reveal disabilities or medical conditions aren't kind of put under a microscope and examined more closely. But if an employee does not perform well or does have problems after disclosing a disability, then the employer should go ahead and discipline them, just make sure everything is documented well. There was a meeting in December for the employee to provide more information on their medical condition. The employee stated that he felt sick, even though he didn't look sick. that he had a fear of prostate problems. His brother-in-law had prostate cancer. I see I had a little typo there. And he also, you know, went on and spoke a bit about his feelings about that. He saw what his brother-in-law went through and stated that if he had the progressive form of prostate cancer, that he himself would have some suicidal thoughts because he didn't want to be what he called bedridden. Again, a couple weeks after this meeting, the employee was again reprimanded for causing disruptions. The court didn't really itemize what those were. I was somewhat curious to see what the disruptions were. And shortly thereafter, it was just a verbal reprimand, so there was no suspension or anything of that kind taken yet against the employee. And then a short time later, the employee told the company that he was going to have a biopsy. And then that same day, he was reprimanded again for the third time, and this time for substandard work, the same day he stated he would have the biopsy. After the biopsy, he was restricted to light duty, and he requested that he be placed on light duty, and he also requested 1 week of vacation leave, not FMLA or ADA leave, but he wanted vacation leave for the week he was scheduled to get the biopsy results. And both the request for light duty, which was substantiated by medical information, and the request for vacation leave, which he was qualified for, were both denied by the company. He was told to speak to his supervisor about the request, but said that he wasn't feeling well that day and he needed to leave. They denied him permission to leave, but because he wasn't feeling well, he left anyway, and in fact ended up going to the emergency room due to complications from his biopsy. He was terminated for insubordination for leaving the company, leaving his work without permission. He, after being terminated, he gave paperwork to the company, medical documentation showing why he left, showing the complications from the biopsy, that he went to the emergency room. But the company said they would not reconsider the termination, and soon thereafter the employee was diagnosed with prostate cancer. He filed suit under the ADA and under the FMLA, and the court looked at the FMLA first, because that's the more liberal law, and that's what should be examined first. And they noticed that there was proper notice under the FMLA. Although the court said it was a close question, they said if he had just said, I feel sick, although I don't look sick, the court said that alone would not be enough. But here the employee also mentioned he had a weak bladder, he mentioned he had a brother-in-law with prostate cancer, and he mentioned his own feelings if he was diagnosed with prostate cancer. And the court said, looking at all those other statements too and reading his statement in context about feeling sick, the court held that it was enough under the FMLA to give the employer notice that he needed leave. And the court said, remember, he was terminated before the diagnosis of cancer was given. The court said even before that point, his condition was an FMLA serious health condition due to the complications that he had from the biopsy, which required several treatments. As a result of the company terminating him, that the court held that the company may have committed FMLA interference and retaliation, and there was enough evidence for the case to get to a jury. However, the court held that his condition at the time of termination, before the diagnosis of cancer, while it may have been a serious health condition, was not an ADA disability, again, under the old analysis, pre-ADA Amendments Act. So that's the Burnett case. It actually brings up a few of the issues that we've discussed so far, so that's why I thought it was a good one to include. And now we'll look at medical certification. The ADA has significant restrictions on disability-related inquiries. If you've seen our webinar on this topic, you know, pre-employment, an employer can ask nothing. After they make a job offer, employers can find out information about incoming employees. And the main thing is for sitting employees, because that's where leave comes in. And for sitting employees, employers are only allowed to seek medical information. One, if there's an accommodation request, then either the disability or the need for the accommodation is not obvious, or if the employer senses that there is performance problems and thinks they're disability-related, or if the employer senses that the employee is posing a significant risk to health or safety of themselves or others in the workplace. As long as there's a reasonable basis for those concerns, then the employer may seek limited amounts of medical information related to those concerns. and there is no government form provided for ADA medical inquiries. Under the FMLA, the Department of Labor does have a medical certification form, which is not required, but is used by many businesses and is recommended by many experts in terms of what to use, because that way you know, as an employer, you're not asking for anything you shouldn't. If an employee needs leave under the FMLA, the employer is entitled to get certification that there is a serious health condition. In EEOC guidance, they held that such an inquiry does comply with the ADA requirements that a medical inquiry be job-related and consistent with business necessity. And the Department of Labor has revised their form to meet the changes in the new regulations. A couple of the new regulation changes are noted here. Employees must submit certifications that are complete and sufficient. If not, the employer must inform the employee the reasons why in writing and allow 7 days for the employee to cure the deficiency. And the employer should ask for medical certification within 5 days of the leave request. And under the ADA also, the employer is allowed to seek additional information if the information provided by the employee is either vague or contradictory. However, under the ADA, there's no requirement that the employer inform the employee in writing the reasons why they need more information, although that's generally considered a good idea. And under the FMLA, unlike the ADA, the employer may require additional medical opinions at the employer's expense or periodic reports not less than every 30 days during leave, and also periodic certification. Under the ADA, it's very limited when an employer may seek additional medical information. It's only if the information provided by the person's doctor is incomplete and has not been cured or is contradictory, or if the employer suspects collusion between the employee and the doctor. Under the FMLA, the employer's rights for seeking medical information is slightly more broad than under the ADA. And here's a case discussing this, the Scone-Fienza case. In this case, an employee with migraines claimed that the employer sent forms for recertification to the wrong address and refused to resend them. The employer, for their part, claimed the employee wouldn't give us their updated address. It sounds almost a little bit like a childish type of complaint, and unfortunately, sometimes in these situations, that is what comes up. So the employee said, I didn't send the certification, but you didn't send it to me. And the employer said, we sent it, you wouldn't give us an address. And the court held that it was the employee's responsibility to provide the required medical certification, and she did not do that. And also in this case, as an aside, the employee was still working there. She was given a verbal warning, presumably the first step of progressive discipline, but that was really the only adverse employment action taken against her. So the court held there wasn't even really an adverse employment action anyway, although I would think even a verbal warning could constitute an adverse employment action. The employee claimed they forced her to use sick time, but she didn't provide any substantiation of that, so the court couldn't even look at that claim. And employees should definitely make sure that they comply with the certification requirements. And under the ADA, too. Okay, I think I got lost, so I'm going to hold down the control key while I talk rather than use the lock button. So I'm not sure where I got lost, but the court held that it was the employee's responsibility to provide the medical certification, which the employee did not do. And this is similar to the ADA also. Under the ADA, if an employee does not provide information that the employer is entitled to, then the employee may be deemed to be responsible for a breakdown in the interactive process. So under either law, the employee should make sure they get their evidence and their certification into the employer. Sorry. I'm going to look at intermittent leave. Remember, leave can be taken for a block of time, but also on a smaller basis until it adds up to 12 weeks. And the new regulations have some items regarding intermittent leave, which I won't go into. It breaks down into what period of leave. Can you do it in 1 minute increments, 1 hour? And I think generally it's just whatever the employer generally uses in terms of a timesheet type of breakdown can be used for the increments of leave. Under the ADA, again, intermittent leave can be a reasonable accommodation if there's no undue hardship. If there is an undue hardship, then an employer must look at other ways. Can we reassign non-essential functions from this employee? Can we perhaps let them go to part-time? Can they be transferred to another position that will enable that they are qualified for? And that's the idea. Do the FMLA, they either qualify for leave and get it, or they don't qualify for leave and don't get it. And in the FMLA, intermittent leave can be taken when medically necessary. Employees must make a reasonable effort to schedule treatment to avoid disruptions to their employer. And one other requirement under the FMLA, if the leave is foreseeable, the employer may require the employee to temporarily transfer during the leave to an available alternative position for which the employee is qualified and which better suits the employee's reduced hours. So this allows the employer some flexibility in terms of moving people around when letting an employee take leave. Maybe they can reassign them temporarily, give them part-time leave, have them work part-time, and that might work out better. Health benefits. Under the ADA, the employer must continue health insurance coverage for an employee taking leave only if the employer also provides coverage for other employees in the same leave or part-time status. Under the FMLA, the employer must always maintain the employee's existing level of coverage as long as the employee pays his or her share of the premium. And the employer must also provide an employee with the same benefits, life, disability insurance, or any other benefits normally provided to an employee in the same leave or part-time status. And that's to prevent discrimination. And the health benefit for many people with disabilities, the protection of health benefits is one of the most important aspects of it. One of the key parts also is reinstatement after leave. Under the ADA, the employee is entitled to return to the same job they had before the leave, assuming they're qualified to do it with or without a reasonable accommodation, as long as there is no undue hardship. If there is an undue hardship, then and there's no accommodations that will alleviate that hardship, then the employer is required to look at whether reassignment to another position is appropriate. Under the FMLA, an employee is entitled to return to the same position or to an equivalent position, and that the FMLA leave cannot result in the loss of any benefit the employee earned or was entitled to before using the FMLA leave. And there is some more I want to go into about the FMLA reinstatement, because there are some reasons why the employer would not have to reinstate the employee. One, if the employee would have been terminated even if not on leave, then the employee does not have a right to reinstatement. This could be if a bona fide reduction in force occurred while the employee was on leave, or for some other reasons, and we're going to look at this issue will come up in the case we're going to look at next. Another exception, this is an important one to the reinstatement provision, is that employees who are termed key employees, and in order to be a key employee, they must be among the highest paid 10% of employees within 75 miles of the work site. If such an individual is in the top 10%, and restoration to employment would cause substantial and grievous injury to the employer, then that employee does not have a right to reinstatement. However, I believe the employer does have to provide them some notification in advance that they will not be reinstated. However, it's important to note, even if a key employee is going to be denied reinstatement, they are still entitled to their 12 weeks of FMLA leave. So we're just talking about what happens at the end of the leave. If they're a key employee, they still get the leave. It's just reinstatement that's at issue. At the end of the leave, if the employee is unable to perform the job with or without an accommodation, unlike the ADA, the FMLA does not require the employer to reinstate the employee into another job and look at transfers. But if the employer is also covered by the ADA, that's when the ADA requirements for reassignment would kick in. And then there's a question, who has a burden of proving the employee would have continued working if not on leave? If the employer terminates the employee while they're on leave, does the employer have to show that they would have terminated them anyway, or does the employee have to show that the employer would not have terminated them if they were not on leave? And here we have the Smith case that deals with that issue. In Smith, the employee admittedly did not provide staff training as he was required to do, and it was not listed as his job duty, but he acknowledged that it was something he was supposed to do, although he did not see it as one of the main job duties, more of a peripheral duty. But he was reprimanded for not doing this, even though it was not listed as an official job duty. I'm sorry, I said he, it's a woman. Soon thereafter, the employee went on 6 weeks of leave for breast cancer. In 2 weeks before returning from the leave, she was terminated for failing to train staff, the same reason that she was verbally reprimanded for before leave. The employer said that they started realizing all the costs that were coming from the lack of training and how it was really hurting the workplace, and they didn't really realize how big a problem it was until the employee was on leave. That's what the employer was saying. The court did not buy it, and it went to a jury trial. The jury didn't buy that argument either. The court held that the employer violated both the ADA, which entitled the employee to punitive damages, and it upheld the jury verdict under the FMLA for the employee. The trial court had thrown out the ADA case, and the appellate court then reinstated it. But even at the trial court, the jury found for the employee under the FMLA. So essentially on appeal, the court put back in the punitive damages under the ADA. And regarding the burden of who has to show the reasons for the termination, the court held it is the employer's burden to show that they would have terminated the employee anyway, even if they were not on leave. And in this case, the employer's reason that that's when she was on leave is when we discovered how bad her mistakes were, that did not work, and the employee won. And again, this case shows why consistent discipline is so important. If someone's terminated while on leave, I think that raises red flags to the courts or soon after disclosing a disability. And it's also important to make sure job descriptions, if an employer wants to argue that, for example, training is an essential function, it's much more beneficial to have that in the job description. One more case on reinstatement. In this case, an employee was not reinstated, and the court upheld the employer's position in not reinstating them due to their performance issues. In this case, a nurse had been experiencing what's termed mood swings, probably related to her depression, and she went on a period of leave. While on leave, the employee continued to show up at work and disrupt the workplace. The court went into great depth telling how she wore a very short skirt that was inappropriate and sat with her legs propped up and was yelling out stuff to her coworkers and otherwise behaving inappropriately. And again, this is while the employee was on leave. She just showed up to work without really any acknowledgement that she was not supposed to be at work. And in this case, the court found, yes, the employer would have discharged the employee anyway, even if she was not on FMLA leave. She was acting inappropriately before the leave and acting inappropriately during the leave. And the court articulated that there is no absolute right to restoration, as well as the fact that there's no strict liability under the FMLA. You have to look at, you know, the facts of each case. So a person does not automatically get the right to restoration, although it is a fairly well-protected right, but if the employer can show they would have terminated the employee anyway, then this employee does not have to be restored. So again, the question I posed earlier, if the FMLA leave is up and the person requests more leave under the ADA, when does it have to be given? When it's reasonable, and that just means when is it not an undue hardship? So, for example, if a company offers long-term medical leave or personal leave policies where you can have a year of leave, then I would think there's a strong argument to make that the person should get 1 year of medical leave under the ADA. And again, the employee still must show eventually they can meet the requirements of the job, both attendance and their other job duties. However, employees that request indefinite leave, those are tough. The courts are very hard on requests for indefinite leave, often saying they're not reasonable. What's usually better if the employee and their doctor can figure out a time frame where the doctor thinks they may be able to come back. And, you know, nothing's perfect. If after a month or 2 months the person's not able to come back, then the doctor can opine as to how much longer it will be. But indefinite leave and requests for indefinite leave are generally not helpful to the employees. In this case, regarding extension of leave, the Gibson case, an employer claimed that an employee who was unable to return to work at the conclusion of the FMLA leave was unqualified to perform their job and therefore not entitled to additional ADA leave. And in this case, the employer had a policy that everyone who was on leave for a certain amount of time would be terminated if they could not come back at the end of that amount of time. And pursuant to this policy, this employee was terminated. In this case, those policies are very much frowned upon on the court. And in this case, the court found for the employee, citing the principle that blanket policies such as this may violate the ADA, as the ADA requires reasonable modifications of policies, such as termination after a period on leave. And in this case, the employer should have engaged in the interactive process to say, okay, you cannot return to work now that your FMLA leave is up. How much more time do you need before you can return to work? Is it 1 month? That would probably be a reasonable amount of leave. Is it 3 years? That would probably not be a reasonable amount of leave. Is it in between? It's a little trickier. You might need to hire a lawyer. But I think generally there's no set guidelines, but generally a month or two is almost always considered reasonable. Often even doubling the amount of FMLA leave is reasonable. And, of course, if the employer has other leave policies that go well beyond 12 weeks up to a year or more, then large amounts of ADA leave may indeed be reasonable for that employer. And then just a word on enforcement. Under the ADA, employees must file a case with the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. Depending if you have a state human rights law and state enforcement, the period for filing is either 180 days if you do not have a similar state ordinance, or in states like Illinois, where there's also an Illinois Human Rights Act and Illinois Department of Human Relations, you have up to 300 days to file with the EEOC, file a charge of discrimination. It's a little different for federal employees. They must report, it can be orally, any discriminatory conduct to the EEO officer within 45 days of any ADA discrimination or Rehab Act discrimination. The statute of limitation under the FMLA, there is no exhaustion requirement. Cases do not go to the EEOC. You have 2 years for general FMLA violations, or a 3-year statute of limitations if the violation was intentional by the employer, and you have two choices. You can either file with the U.S. Department of Labor and file a claim with them, or you can go straight to the federal courthouse and file a lawsuit in federal court under the FMLA. It gets a little trickier when people have both claims, because the ADA claim needs to be exhausted first. And if the EEOC sits on the case too long, then you worry about the FMLA statute of limitations. So it's very important to make sure you have all those dates in mind. State court enforcement depends on the state's human rights laws. And if you're interested, the Department of Labor has info. Many states have family medical leave laws, and the Department of Labor has a breakdown on those. So I'm going to take a break here. The case study I kind of intended as a bonus if there weren't many questions. The case study is in the brief that will be distributed later, and I think there's 22 questions, and the answers to the questions are put in there also, so you kind of have the teacher's edition. For purposes of the PowerPoint, I just picked out a few questions to put in here in case we have time to discuss it. But at this point, I'm going to turn it back over to Robin and then throw it over for questions.
Thank you, Alan, and hopefully everyone can hear me. I was losing you a couple times, Alan. I'm not sure if others did as well, but hopefully everything came through okay for everyone. We've got a couple of questions that were sent in to me, but I will also allow for people to submit some questions here using the chat area, or if you have a microphone, just raise your hand, and we will call on you as well to answer to ask a question. At this point, are there any questions that anyone from the audience has that they would like to pose to Alan at this time? Alan, I had a question from that was sent in to us earlier, and I'll go ahead and do that now while I'm waiting to see if there's anyone who has other questions. And you may feel that you answered, I just want to make sure for the participants that they feel that you also that they answered it adequately enough, but or not, but what if an individual, is there any option or other than key employee for an employer to deny a FMLA leave. Like as you have under the ADA, you've got an undue hardship defense for providing a reasonable accommodation, of course, of which leave is a reasonable accommodation. With the FMLA, you have the provisions, you know, related to key persons and such, key employees. Would there, if I was not a key employee, be, from your knowledge, any other kind of similar defense?
Robin, first I just want to clarify one thing. Key employees are still entitled to the leave. It is only the reinstatement aspect that they're not entitled to, but key employees still do get leave. But other than the conditions I talked about before, again, under the ADA, it's very different. It's a balancing act. And I hear employers kind of complain about both kinds. Well, who knows what's reasonable in the ADA? It's vague. It's confusing. And I kind of see that as the law's attempt to balance the competing interest of the employer and the employee and be fair. Under the FMLA, it's a different analysis. The analysis is really, does the employee have a serious health condition? If yes, have they been working for more than 12 months at the employer? Have they worked 1,250 hours? If all those things fit, then they get the leave under the FMLA. And then the key employee, and they would have fired them anyway, that, all that stuff only goes to reinstatement. But the leave, and feel free to correct me if I'm wrong, Barry, or anyone else, but my understanding is under the FMLA, if you meet the qualification criteria, you get the leave. And the employer can transfer someone if it's intermittent leave, but if the person meets the FMLA requirements, they get the leave. There is no undue hardship, reasonableness type of analysis.
Yeah, I would agree with Alan. I think that's absolutely right. The only thing that I was just going to add to that as far as making sure that you meet all the requirements as an employee is the new FMLA regulations are a little bit stricter on employees regarding notice. And I think it's arguable that if they don't follow these stricter requirements for notice that an employer could deny FMLA leave on that basis. So like now it says that if the employee is required to provide the 30 days notice and fails to do so, then they have to provide reasons why the notice wasn't practicable if the employer asked for it. And if they don't come up with a good reason, I think it's arguable that the employer could say, well, then you're not entitled to the leave. The other thing I wanted to just mention while I have the microphone is on the administrative enforcement issue, Alan gave the example of somebody filing with the EEOC and not getting a resolution in time to file with the federal court within the FMLA's two-year period. The other thing that can also happen is the person could file with the Department of Labor and have that process take too long. If that lasts over the two-year period and the person doesn't file in federal court, they'll lose their FMLA rights too. So the fact that there isn't an exhaustion requirement under the FMLA is really different from the ADA. The ADA says you file with the EEOC and your time to file in federal court is told until the EEOC finishes investigation, then they give you a right to sue letter, then you have 90 days. Whereas with the FMLA, if you file with the Department of Labor and are waiting for them to make a decision and 2 years passes and you don't file in federal court, you could lose your FMLA rights as well.
I saw a couple of questions in the chat section. I'm going to go backwards and do the one from Barbara first. I probably didn't explain it well. What I'm saying, if the employer has policies where people can be on medical leave or personal leave for a year, which many big companies have, then I'm saying that under the ADA, the person might be entitled to ADA leave for up to a year because the employer has other leave policies. Therefore, it would probably be reasonable for them to provide the same period of ADA leave that they do for personal leave or other types of leave. And the question from Tanya, key employees, well, it's under the Reinstatement Act. It's all under the Family Medical Leave Act. What I'm saying is key employees are protected differently or unprotected differently when it comes to reinstatement. If they do meet the criteria for a key employee and the employer gave them the notice that they are considered a key employee, then they might not be entitled to reinstatement I took my finger off the button to check the paper. But as long as if there's a grievous and substantial injury to the employer, then the key employee does not have to be reinstated. So they are protected differently. They're protected less. They still get the leave, but not reinstatement. And then I saw a question from Salima. There are no ADA forms similar to FMLA forms. If you want to talk to me offline, I can probably, we have some sample forms we can probably provide you with. So if she's on long-term disability, then it kind of depends internally how you want to classify her leave in terms of her work status. And I see there's one more question here from Michelle. Should employers give notice to key employees that are key as a matter of course before FMLA is requested? I don't think so, because, I mean, you don't want to guess who has serious health conditions or whose family members might get sick or who might decide to adopt or have foster children or get pregnant. But it is important that if the person asks for leave that you look at the FMLA regs and comply with the notice provisions for key employees then. Otherwise, you will not be able to deny reinstatement at the end of the leave. But I don't think doing it in advance of FMLA leave is necessarily necessary. Okay, I'll throw it open for any more questions.
This is Robin, and I just want to make sure that people are clear on the fact that the intent in the FMLA regulations is that key employee is very narrowly defined, not widely defined. You're really talking about someone who's a CEO or as a critical decision maker in the organization, not just someone you may believe is a key employee because they happen to do a certain job or a certain task. I mean, it is somewhat defined narrowly in the FMLA regulations as to who would fit into that category of key employee.
I see that question from Tanya regarding pregnancy. And generally, pregnancy by itself has not been deemed a disability under the ADA. There is another law called the Pregnancy Discrimination Act, which would cover adverse action against people who are pregnant. But some related conditions to pregnancy, such as gestational diabetes and some other things that might require bed rest and things like that, could be deemed a disability. But pregnancy by itself without other disabling conditions has typically not been deemed an ADA disability. And I think Alan can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that would hold true even under the ADA Amendments Act.
Right. No, thanks, Barry. That's my understanding as well. So I'll pause a second. If there's no more questions, we'll start a little bit of the case study, but let's see if anyone else has any other questions first.
Alan and Barry, I had another question that was submitted, which just basically was, if an employer knows that an employee is taking personal time, sick time, or vacation time for a health condition, can they designate that leave under FMLA, even if the employee has not requested that the leave be designated under FMLA?
I lost a little. Are you asking whether the employee or the employer can designate the time? Hi, Robin. I'm sorry. I lost part of the question. Kind of faded for a second. I think generally the employer can call it FMLA time even if the employee didn't specifically request it to be FMLA time, as long as it meets all the requirements and criteria, if I'm understanding your question correctly. Okay, well, I'm going to move on to the case study. First of all, there's two pictures here. One is a woman, you can't kind of tell this, but she's actually stabbing someone. And if anyone can tell me why that picture is there, we'll give you $10 off your next webinar. Can we do that, Robin? I don't know. Well, I'll do it out of my pocket if anyone can tell me what that picture is from and why it's included here. That's the picture on the left. Okay, on to the case study. This involves Julia and Scarpia's Print Shop. For the last 3 years, Julia has worked for Scarpia's, printing and copying services as a part-time sales associate working midday shift. They have 14 stores in a 30-mile radius, and a total of 46 full-time and 18 part-time employees. Typically, she works, Julia, 3 days a week from 7 to 4 and paid for 9 hours a day. During her first 3 years of employment, Julia was considered a very reliable employee and was rarely late or absent from work. Julia uses a scooter as a result of having multiple sclerosis, which affects her ability to walk. As her work site is accessible, the only accommodation she's really needed so far was to have a reserved, accessible parking space near her entrance. Last January, Julia started to arrive late for work at least once a week. She would tell her supervisor, Ben, that she was not feeling well and that she would be on time next time. She would not be late again. But she was late several times, a total of 6 of these incidents, and at that time, Ben, her supervisor, scheduled a meeting with Julia to discuss the issue. At that meeting, Ben informed Julia that her lateness was unacceptable because the day shift employees could not take their break until Julia arrived for her afternoon shift. He also informed her that she was being written up for being late and would continue to be disciplined for each time that she was late pursuant to the company progressive discipline policy, and she would be terminated if she was late two more times without an excuse pursuant to that policy. Immediately after hearing this, Julia told Ben that her lateness was a result of problems she had due to medication that she takes for depression. The medication makes it difficult for her to fall asleep. It makes it difficult for her to wake up. And her sleep problems have gotten worse since Julia's mother died a couple of months ago. Julia did not give the name of the medication, but indicated that her doctor thought she would need to take 6 weeks off from work for therapy and to adjust her medication. And she has not used any of her medical leave time up to this point. Okay, so let's get to the discussion questions. One, is Julia requesting an ADA reasonable accommodation? And second part is she requesting leave under the FMLA? So I'll pause a second. If anyone thinks they know the answer or wants to pipe in, speak up. Otherwise, I'll continue, but I'll take a quick pause. Okay. So no one's brave enough to step up. I don't mean to impugn people's courage. Is Julia requesting an ADA reasonable accommodation? Yes, she is. There's no, as we mentioned, there's no magic words, no formal language. As long as the plain meaning of the request reasonably alerts the employer to the need for leave. Is she requesting leave under the FMLA? And the answer is pretty much the same. Yes, she is. There's no magic words. She told the employer enough to know she may need leave. Okay, let's look at the next question. Is Scarpia entitled to more medical information? If so, what information should be sought? If her employer is concerned that Julia's depression may affect her MS, can the company request info on Julia's MS? And can the company send Julia to another doctor for a second opinion? Anyone? And then we also have some more. Can Scarpia use its company doctor? And then what are the requirements under the ADA and FMLA? Cindy pipes in, no inquiry about the MS. Absolutely true, Cindy. Under both laws, the employer is only entitled to information about this disability giving rise to the need for leave. And in this case, that is Julia's depression. So the employer is only entitled to information about that. And again, the information must be limited to that disability and the need for leave. I think there's another question here. Oh, okay. Why would it be ADA? The depression is not caused by her MS. If I understand your question right, Susan, the ADA covers mental impairments and physical impairments. So even a person with depression and no other types of conditions might be considered covered by the ADA, especially now under the ADA Amendments Act. And then there's a question about going to the company doctor. Can they send her to the company doctor? And Phyllis is right. The company cannot force her to go to a company doctor. Under the ADA and under the FMLA, they can send her for a second opinion, but I believe under the new regulations, there is a requirement that the second opinion cannot be for a company doctor. So, good call by Phyllis, good call, also by Cindy. Okay, any other points from this question that people have? And again, for the company doc, no second opinion under the ADA. For the FMLA, they can, but it cannot be the company doctor. Okay, I think maybe we'll look at, I was going to say one more question, and then I see there's six on the next slide. Maybe we'll do another question or two, And then, Robin, you can just let me know when we want to break for the closing comments. Should Scarpia's response to closure and her need from time off work? If so, how? Anyone have any thoughts on that? Okay, well, under the ADA, Scarpia's has a duty to engage in the interactive process to determine whether to leave, or if they want to pick a different effective accommodation, they can do that. Whether leave or another accommodation would be effective for Julia. Under the FMLA, Scarpia's should respond. Since she did make a bona fide request for leave, they should respond with the medical certification form, most probably, and then Julia should get the leave as long as she's an eligible employee. And must the company grant the leave? The ADA, I don't know if we really have enough information to answer in terms of whether it's an undue hardship or not. The company would have to show some type of reason why it would be an undue hardship. Under the FMLA, if Julia meets the eligibility requirements, no undue hardship criteria, she gets the leave. Under question E, if Julia is eligible for leave under the FMLA and the ADA, how should the initial leave period be characterized? And that's going back to what I said before about from the EEOC guidance, that you look at the law that offers the broadest protection to the employee, which is generally the FMLA. So the initial leave period should be characterized as FMLA leave. Question F, must the company rescind the discipline that was mentioned prior to Julia disclosing her depression? And the law and EEOC guidance on this is clear, that discipline does not have to be rescinded just because the employer learns after the fact of a disability. If the employer knows of the disability before instituting the discipline and know that the disability related to the discipline or was related to the discipline, then the employer may need to look at accommodating the disability. But in this case, Julia was disciplined for being late, and after that disclosed her issue with depression, but the discipline can still stand. G, may the company monitor her treatment, and if so, how? I know I'm going right ahead. If anyone has anything they want to pipe in for these answers, please feel free. Under the ADA, the employer may request reasonable medical updates. And again, reasonable is not defined, but generally every day would be a little too much, and generally monthly is considered reasonable. And under the FMLA, the employer can request recertification at reasonable intervals, but no more often than every 30 days for an update. And I think I'll pause here. I see someone just typed in a question. Oh, Barry is indicating under the new regulations, the employer may contact the employee's health care provider directly for clarification and authentication of the medical certification. If the employee denied the employer permission to contact the provider, then the employer can deny leave if there's still an unclear part of the certification. And under the ADA 2, the employer does have the right to contact an employee's doctor. However, it's always important to obtain a release before doing so. But thanks, Barry, for pointing that out. And seeing how we only have a few minutes left, I just wanted to jump ahead to some of the resources we had very quickly. Oops, I lost it. Here they are, the resources. One, the sponsor and host for the program is the DIBTAC Great Lakes ADA Center. If you have future questions, if you're in Illinois, or if you want to contact us at Equip for Equality, we're happy to help. And we also have the Illinois ADA Project in Illinois, which is funded from the DIBTAC. And you can contact me if you want to contact the ADA Project. Again, the Job Accommodation Network is helpful on these issues. And then there's some information for a copy of the FMLA, the Department of Labor, and some ADA technical assistance. So with that, I'm going to turn it back over to Robin.
Great. Thank you very much. Can you, first of all, just want me to verify that you can, that you're able to hear me okay, because I had a period there that I was talking and I guess nobody was able to hear me. So hopefully you can hear me. Great. Anyway, thank you everyone for your participation today, and thank you to Alan and Barry for your information. I know that there's a great deal of confusion always on this issue of leave and who it applies to and how does it apply to, and the nuances between the FMLA and the ADA, because they sometimes appear that they're minor, but yet can be stickler points when dealing with an employee and understanding, am I actually working with this person now on FMLA leave, even if they, you know, are a person with a disability, because they would be subject to the FMLA regulations when their leave is FMLA leave. Just because I have a disability doesn't mean all of my leave is ADA leave. So it's it does become a confusing point of this. You will be receiving a copy of the PowerPoint presentations as well as a legal brief that was prepared by Barry and Alan regarding this particular issue. That will be coming to you via email attachment subsequent to the conclusion of this particular program, along with information related to the evaluation, and asking you to please complete the evaluation form as well. So at this point, I'll just see if there's anyone to see whether or not anybody has any last-minute questions or any comments before we sign off. But we do encourage you to join us. The session will also be archived as soon as we can get the transcript prepared and available. We will also archive this session for reference back if you're interested as well. And that will include the questions and the responses as well as the discussion by Barry and Alan and others on this particular topic. So without further ado, I will say my goodbyes to everyone. And again, thank you, and hope you'll join us for next session. Barry and Alan, if you have any other comments, I'll let you say them at this time before we sign off.
Nothing to say other than thank you all, and we appreciate all your questions and your involvement.
Alan, I think people wanted you to give the answer to the quiz that you gave them.
Okay. Well, I should put you on the spot, Barry, because I once asked you this before. Scarpia is, I think, my favorite bad guy in all of opera. And that's a picture from the opera Tosca, where he appears, and that's Maria Callas as Tosca. He wants her to give herself over to him to save her lover's life, and she says yes, and then stabs him and stands over him screaming. So that's who Scarpia is, so I got to save my $10.
Okay, great. Thank you, everyone, and thank you, Alan, for adding a little bit of cultural context to the program, and everyone have a great day. Thanks. Bye-bye.